Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, evening, everyone. My apologies for being wildly overdressed. This is my day night job as a wine waiter around the corner, and I'm afraid I've got to sort of go more or less immediately off from here. But I was really determined to make sure that I was here for the launch. The heavy lifting will be done by the admirable sub-selection of commissioners we have for you tonight, and I hope you'll put them through a grilling to make sure that we share as much as we can. I just want to say a few words at the beginning before I have to go to say, when we launched in this room, there was quite a lot of conversation about the context of which we were doing things. This is, and actually I remember one particularly ambitious type who said, well, why are you bothering to do this sort of two-year review? Because it'll all be done by the time we get to the end of this year. So we're here in October, and I'm pretty sure Brexit hasn't happened yet. And actually, a lot of the things that we're talking about are increasingly clearly going to be multi-year, very serious strategic questions. So the whole point of the Commission and the way we've approached this, I think, is even more valid than it was when we started, and we've already learnt a lot. And I just want to talk a little bit briefly about how we've tried to approach this, and then pick out a couple out of the elements in the progress report that you'll hear. And this is very much a progress report. This is not the final article. So the point about this is we set out to do something deliberately different. A, it's completely independent, and thanks again to Esme Fairbairn for funding us and the RSA for supporting us and the Secretariat support and obviously this wonderful room. But that has been a deliberate choice to bring a wide variety of talents and skills from public health, the WI, to commerce and Sainsbury's, farmers, and it's a broad church of interested parties. And I think that diversity is really important, because what we need to do as a commission is think about this as a system-wide set of challenges, as opposed to disappearing down individual stovepipes or single concern questions, which is, you know, there are lots of issues in this space, it's a very broad agenda, but actually by forcing us to think about how do these things join up, and where are the links, and where can we bring a different point of view, which is additive to what's being done, because there's a huge amount of great work in here, and what we're not trying to do is reinvent the wheel. And I think the other thing that's been really great about the way the team have approached this is we've really tried to get out on the ground around the UK and really understand the local dimension. So thank you, A, to the people that peddled around the UK, and I see Kenny at the back there, and also to the people that welcomed our bike tours and gave us huge amounts of material, and you'll see some of the videos and the material later. I think getting out of Westminster, getting out of the Whitehall bubble, and really talking to the people that care is vital, because it's very clear that local communities both care and don't feel that they have enough controls over the levers that affect their lives. So what we want to do is join up those systems and understand the total flows in what's happening, because we can focus on 3.1 billion of farm payments. Actually, there's, you know, over 20 billion of other payments running through the countryside. And actually what we need to do is map those and understand how they interact and what we can do to direct them to have systemic benefit. So what we're announcing today is a framework, and I'll ask Sue to talk about the themes in the framework, and importantly an idea of things we already think are no regrets. We should get on and do things now. We've got lots of interesting examples of things that we think we can just carry on with. So one would be, you know, Princess Countryside Fund has suggested we should be having a scheme to build retirement homes on farms to allow farmers to move on and let the young generation through. It's currently got a planning problem. What can we do about that? There's a lot of detail there, but there's a huge, I think, sort of clarity now around the framework. And do it, test it, and debate it is the framework we've come up with. And that is really the call tonight and in the next phase of work to everyone here, is how can you help us refine and finish the thinking so that we can end up with the pragmatic, radical view that we want to get to of how we can fundamentally change the system. And I'll leave you with the two things that struck me out of the first stage of the progress report, which is firstly that we are connecting quite deliberately, and thank you to Shirley and others for this. We're connecting food farming in the countryside to public health. Public health is the ultimate public good. And if we're going to pay public money for outcomes, then health needs to be part of this conversation. And I think that's a very genuine new contribution to this debate. And the final thing I want to touch on is a call which we've made today, which is to start to move the entire farming system to a more sustainable future in line with the Sustainable Development Goals over 10 years, with a consistent attempt to rebase the system into something which we can genuinely say is good for our country, good for our environment, and good for our public's health. And that is a very big challenge. It's a very classic RSA-type challenge, and it won't happen overnight. But I think that's the sort of the challenge that we're looking for the next phase. So, tremendous start. Thank you for everyone who's contributed. Thank you particularly to the 14 other commissioners who have been incredibly generous with their time. I think we are now well into this with some interesting things to say today, but we need the next stage of debate, which starts tonight. Please contribute, and please let us know how we can get to something really meaningful at the end of this particular journey. Thanks very much, and good night, and I'll hand over to Sue.
Thank you, Sir Ian. And I'm going to say now he's left the room that he is actually having to leave us to go to His Royal Highness Prince Charles's birthday party. So that was the only thing that trumped this event tonight. And I think we were prepared to give him a bye on that basis. So otherwise he would have been here right to the bitter end. So we've brought together a panel of our commissioners. We have other commissioners in the front too, but we have a panel of commissioners here this evening to talk a little bit more about the sorts of things that we've been exploring over the last year and the insights that they've been able to glean from that process. We have David Fursden, who is chair of Beeswax Dyson Farming Limited, and he's particularly interested in the interaction between commercial farming and the environment. David's also a trustee of the National Trust and a qualified rural chartered surveyor with a background in private practice and in consultancy. Judith Batchelor is director of Sainsbury's Brand and co-chair of the Agri-Food Tech Council, and she's worked in the food and drink industry for 35 years, who'd have thought it, and is a biochemist and a registered nutritionist. David Pension is an honorary professor and associate down at the University of Exeter. He's a UK-trained doctor and was the founder of the Sustainable Development Unit for NHS England and Public Health England. And finally, on the end, we have Professor Tim Jackson, who is Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey and Director of the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. You'll probably know Tim, who's written extensively on the complex relationship between economic growth, well-being and sustainability, and he's author of the acclaimed Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. So we'll hear short contributions from each of our panellists shortly, and then we're very keen to hear your comments, your observations, your thoughts. So we'll open up conversation after our discussions on stage. But before we move on, I just want to say a couple of things about the work that we've done. You probably are a bit curious about how we've got to where we are and what we've been doing for the last year. So our research has focused on two things, the research and public engagement. And we started out at the start of the year scanning the policy and research territory. We looked at over 1,000 policy proposals from the last 3 years, and we shared our analysis through an interactive tool on our website. We hear that the policy geeks amongst you loved it. We highlighted the gaps that we noticed, and we invited your contributions in our call for ideas. We synthesised those responses into our cross-cutting themes, supported by our multidisciplinary research advisory group made up of senior academics from around the UK. We set up devolved inquiries in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, and in three counties in England, Cumbria, Lincolnshire and Devon, which are ongoing. In addition, as Ian mentioned, we embarked on an innovative and ambitious project to speak to people all over the UK. Yes, my team travelled the UK on a bike, going to those places where most consultations frankly don't reach, from Sheldwick to Shetland, Cardigan to Cromer, Armagh to St Austell. They met farmers, foresters, fisherfolk and growers, food processors and retailers. They visited community groups, hospitals, care homes and schools and many more places. And they were welcomed with kindness and consideration wherever they went. So I just want to take a moment to say something on that here. We hear so much today of broken Britain, the tribalism, the conflicts, and the anxieties that we're all facing. When I said in the office upstairs a year ago, it's really important that we get round the country to meet people where they are, to find out what matters to them. And wouldn't it be great if we went on a bike? No one laughed at me, at least not very much and not perhaps to my face. And our research team stepped up, joined by volunteers from other parts of the organisation, and indeed from partners outside the organisation. And they set off. Some of them, frankly, not very familiar with farming and countryside matters, but in a spirit of inquiry and genuine curiosity to find out about the UK food and farming systems, the countryside and the people who live there. And they discovered so much. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you, cyclists, all of you, for your commitment and your willingness to literally go that extra mile for our work. And to the people they met all around the UK, I know some of you are in the room tonight and some of you are watching on the live stream, thank you. Thank you for welcoming them with such warmth, with such generosity, sharing your knowledge, your experiences, often bed and board, and giving them an insight into your worlds to help our work. So where did all this take us? Our five cross-cutting themes were worked up and tested with roundtables and inquiries through the summer and the autumn. First, we talked about our place in the world, where we asked, what could the UK's role be in the world now to take our leadership in combating those critical global challenges like climate change? Second, we talked about securing the value of our land, in which we explore how to make the best use of our land, from the soil beneath our feet to how we balance our needs for food and forestry, housing, energy, and so on. Third, we talked about good work for a thriving economy, in which we considered the changing patterns of work in rural communities and people's aspirations for meaningful work and rich lives. Fourth, we talk about good food for healthy and flourishing communities, in which we connect what we farm, what and how we eat, and its impacts on the public's health. And finally, we talked in our last theme about the whole resource, more than money, and actually probably most influenced by what we were finding on the bike tour. And there we look more closely at all the resource flows through our rural economies and how we align them more effectively to get better outcomes for citizens. So in the report, you'll find a number of topics elaborated in each of these sections. And I'm just going to pick out some of the big ones to give you a flavour. So as Ian mentioned earlier, we talk about a 10-year transition plan for agriculture, which helps the UK meet its commitment to the SDGs. And also we want to work out what investments are needed to make that happen. We want to consider a national land use framework and the mechanisms to achieve this, to mediate and negotiate those complex debates about land use and land stewardship. We make a case for a more inclusive debate about open data in food and farming, what matters, what gets measured, who has access to it, to enable innovation throughout the supply chain. We argue for broader membership of the food and drink sector industry bodies to include public health representatives and citizens' voices to take collective leadership to reverse the upward trend in diet-related ill health. And we want to map the money flows through our rural economies so that we can devolve more decision-making to rural communities backed up by the resources to support the practical actions that lead to real and sustainable change. So you can read more about those in the report in the fullness of time. Now, let's hear from some of our commissioners. David, I'm going to start with you. Would you kick us off with a few of your thoughts?
Okay, well, I haven't got a party to go to, so I'm here. And I didn't go on the bike either, so I'm amazed I've been invited to say a few words. But it's been a really stimulating time. I think what I've enjoyed about it is the fact that we've been listening to some new voices. I think those people that operate in this space probably see the same people talking about the same things on a regular basis. But actually, the fresh ideas and the new faces that we see have been really stimulating. So that's been great. I think we've all recognised that this is very difficult. A lot of this is contested space in the jargon. And it will involve people giving a bit of ground. And I think that recognising that people have got to give a bit of ground in order to meet and drive something forward, I think is the first step that we need to have in this commission. It's a particularly difficult time to do it. Ian mentioned that in his introduction. We are just after the publication of the Agriculture Bill and before the publication of the Environment Bill. We are facing either a deal Brexit or a no deal Brexit. And all this detail that will flow from that will affect what we're doing. But we're trying to get the principles right. And we're also aware of the unintended consequences. Because this is a very complicated area, you can have one hand on the tiller in one place and it can affect something that you hadn't thought of somewhere else. And I think we've got to try and make sure that that doesn't happen, or at least that we know what the consequences are of what we're talking about. So I come at this from somebody who farms a small acreage at home, who is chairman of a company that farms a big acreage. And so I have an interest in the commercial side of agriculture. But I'm also, as Sue said, a trustee of the National Trust, and I do quite a lot in environmental ways at home, and have been in stewardship schemes since they were introduced. So I see the environmental benefits that we can gain if we get this right. And thirdly, I understand about rural communities. I've chaired our parish for 35 years, not too many other volunteers actually, but so I do understand about communities as well. And if you bring all those three together, those three pillars of sustainability, you realise that the answer is going to be somewhere in the middle rather than somewhere clustered around one of those pillars. And I think that's what we have to recognise. I also come at this as a geographer by training, and that tells me that we have to some extent, follow the geography. In my experience, if you're trying to make land and systems do things that they don't naturally want to do, then you're more likely to have a problem as a result of that. Which brings me on to the land use framework, which Sue has mentioned. And I don't think we're looking at a sort of top-down directive sort of land use framework, but we are looking at trying to follow the geography and trying to understand the various competing demands there are for land use and seeing what we can do, various things we can do in one place. And so that's a really interesting thing for me. The west of this country is wetter and steeper and more difficult to bicycle over than the east. And that requires different answers, and it's not one size doesn't fit all in a lot of the solutions that we're looking for. And that points a little bit to local decision making, and we reference that in our report. And that you've got to be careful about that. I mean, some of the local governance that I've seen couldn't organise a piss up in a brewery, but others could, and that isn't consistent right across the piece. So getting that right is a challenge, I think, and it often leads further to local design for environmental schemes, for example, where people understand it and actually want to make it work in a better way than imposing something from above. I'm also interested in the design of communities and mixed use housing and all of that, again, as a geographer, and that's important. I'm interested in innovation, and we flagged up innovation. Sue mentioned the data at the moment, and I think using innovation cleverly, and that's what we're trying to do a bit at Beeswax Dyson, you can increase your production but limit your impact and your inputs on the environment. You can reduce administration, you can get technical ways to check things rather than filling in endless forms. And also, if you can get broadband to the right places, you can have different ways of doing business there as well. Finally, I think if you live on the same patch of land and for a long period of time, as I've done, and you notice what's happening to the flora and the fauna and the land use, and you know that the climate is changing. And so, you know, that's fairly scary, and you'll see our comments on the carbon factor that we're trying to deal with and how to deal with that, or at least we feel we need a solution to that. So we think this is basically the beginning of a process. We're inviting you all to take part, and I hope that the end will give us answers to some of those things that I've mentioned and the other commissioners will mention. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Judith, you come at this from a slightly different perspective, from the retail sector, but you're also involved in a number of cross-sector bodies who are seeking to influence government and bring about change on a number of fronts. What sort of things have you been particularly interested in the last year?
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Good. I'm interested in the sort of global to national to local to individual and how all of that works, because the context of the world that we live in, and particularly in this country, is that I think in the last 10 years, according to the UN FAO, global trade in food and drink has trebled. In the same time frame, we are now less self-sufficient in producing the food and drink that we consume than in the last 50 years. And the combination of those two things means that we're more exposed to a more dynamic world than ever before. And the thing that surprised me when we went through all of this is that whilst in many ways we're all really interdependent and interconnected, as individuals, we're probably feeling more disconnected with everything that's going on above us than ever before. So how do we reconnect the individual to the local, national, global? Because that is the crux of it for me. And it sounds obvious, but it's come out loud and clear in everyone that we've talked to. And that sometimes that feeling of helplessness. The good thing is that, as we've just heard, there is a real change in the way that we are thinking about things. So we are thinking about the triple bottom line of sustainability and the fact that you can't have everything, and that genuinely we have to make trade-offs. But we can only make trade-offs if we think in a systems way. And of course, that's not a natural thing to do. We all think in silos or through our own lens. So one of the great things that has come out of this work is that we have had a set of lenses looking at these problems that aren't the usual suspects, and that we have had some really interesting insights, I think, about how we can join up the dots better and how we can think in a more systems-led way that acknowledges the fact that you can't optimise everything, and that we live in a world where there is compromise. And for probably the first time ever, we have the data, the insights and the technology to make those trade-offs intelligently, thoughtfully, and if we're clever, without the unintended consequences. So we like to talk about the unintended benefits of some of the things that we might do as being a nice surprise. The other thing that came out for me was the fact that if you start to buy into the idea of systems thinking, you realise how difficult it is to make long-lasting structural change, because so many of the things that come up, particularly in the conversations and the dialogues that we've been having, are either tactical, cyclical, or short-term issues that distort the bigger structural picture. And our job, and particularly with everything that we're facing now with Brexit, is how do we drive that long-term structural change that we want to see in these complex systems at global and local level, while still making sure that we have an eye on the tactical short-term things that are coming our way thick and fast. So that sounds all quite depressing, I know, but actually there was a great deal of optimism, because I think the thinking is we haven't done these things before, and the opportunity, if you start to think in that way and you take a long-term, more structural, systematic view of our food system, it starts to become obvious where you can perhaps disaggregate things and re-aggregate them in a way that is better, but also re-aggregate them in a way that is better for multiple stakeholders. And I think one of the things that we talked about was there is an idea of sort of public money for public goods, but actually it's not about goods, it is about value, and it's about multiple stakeholder value. So we felt very optimistic about that, and we think there are lots of opportunities out there. The other reason we think there are lots of opportunities is we do have a common language at global level, and indeed, once we sort the metrics out, we have a common currency, which is the UN SDGs. And if you look at those, there are 17 of them, 8 of them, and actually probably more than 8 indirectly, relate to food, agriculture, health. And they are there, everyone has signed up to them, and you can actually see how those goals can work at a global level, a national level, a local level, and even at a personal level. And I think that's a really powerful concept, and a lot of the things that we've been talking about are completely aligned with those goals. The other thing I think that is really interesting is while all of this is happening, the industry that I work in, and it may not feel like that from where you're sitting, is probably more collaborative than ever before. And we recently formed a food and drink sector council that has every representation from farming all the way through to customers, every part of the value chain. And our job is to work in an interdisciplinary way, in a value chain systems way, a joined up way, to create the kind of change that we all want to see. And if I think about some of the more recent things where the pace at which change has been made, the pace at which we have signed up to things as a sector, and the way we have aligned ourselves around regulation, reporting and compliance on things like the UK Plastics Pact. And the UK Plastics Pact is going to be the basis of the global plastics pack and the circular economy, plastics economy, that's coming soon. Those things are unprecedented in both the scale and the pace at which we've moved. And I think I feel very optimistic that if we can do it for that, we can do it for lots of other things, whether that's the way we use our lands, the way we use our precious resources. And I suppose I'll finish, because I'm going to get the look from Sue. It's not long to say how much work's been done. We actually quite like rules and regulations, and we like the framework that gives us the freedom to operate. And I know it's a bit of a hackneyed phrase, freedom within a framework, but actually there's a general view that big companies don't like regulation. And what we don't like is poor regulation or poor policy making. But intelligent, well-informed regulation that has multiple stakeholder benefits gives us a freedom to move at pace and at scale that is absolutely necessary if we're to make the changes we want to see in the food system in which we operate. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Judith. Now, we're going to hear next from David Pension. We tend to stick with David's on the commission. It makes it easier to remember all the men's names. Obviously not Tim. But David's expertise is as a public health doctor, but has also worked extensively with the Sustainable Development Goals and helping the NHS to consider exactly what it means to bring those into the healthcare system. David, what have you been thinking about this year?
Well, I thought I'd just spend a few minutes telling you a story, really. So I worked for about 35, 40 years in the NHS. So have you all heard of the NHS? Yeah? Fine. So you may think that, actually, I'm not a food expert, I'm not a farming expert either. So if you want your money back after tonight, there's someone outside who will give you your money back. But I'd like to say I dealt with health when I was in the health service, but I don't think actually that's true, because I don't think the NHS is particularly interested in health. I actually don't think doctors are very knowledgeable about health either. So towards the latter part of my career in the NHS, I, as Sue said, took on this role of looking at how you could reformulate certain parts of the NHS to actually promote health, not just minimise the effects of disease, but actually, and not just prevent disease, but actually make the place we live healthier, to make the institutions we're part of healthier, to make the society we're part of healthier. So I want to tell you a quick story, really, about a good friend of mine I met while I was doing that work for the past decade or so. His name is John. So John is an assistant catering manager in a hospital in the Midlands. Now, you might not think, oh, that doesn't sound very influential, but I just want to tell you what John did with the hospital system in the Midlands. First of all, did you know that the NHS is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, buyer of food in the country? Do you know that? Okay, so that gives it enormous, not just power, but responsibility to do it in a healthy, sustainable, fair way, which is an enormous challenge while the NHS is trying to do lots of other things. Okay, the other thing you may not know is much of the food that's served to you and me while we're patients in hospitals is made, is prepared in another country. Okay, not in England, in Wales. Okay, and it is shipped through the night by big juggernauts to various hospitals throughout. Now, that is a stupid food system. That is stupid. Okay, but it's evolved that way because of the economic realities, because of incentives, because of certain rather weird interpretations of European law. It's not a great way to do it. So the first thing John did was to say, right, we're going to stop this. We'll go out to our local farmers in the county and say, would you like to help produce food for the hospitals in this county? And they said, whoa, hold on a second. We've never, ever tried to take on the big boys in terms of food distribution systems to the NHS. So he said, I'll help you. So now in the hospital food systems, this is in Nottinghamshire, by the way, 15% of all food served in Nottinghamshire hospitals is organic. 75% is locally sourced. Okay. Now, what this means is, you think, well, that'll be costly, wouldn't it? Well, actually, John did this in an entirely cost-neutral way. He's brought £2 million into the county's economy per year. He's increased the employment rate in meaningful catering businesses in the hospitals. Okay. And most of all, he's won a Soil Association Gold Award for it, which is really, really important, a very prestigious award from a very important organisation. Now, that is a good news story. I hope you'll agree. If you disagree, I'll do some arm wrestling with you outside. That is a good news story. There's an example of something called a virtuous cycle upwards. There's win, 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 win. It just goes up and up and up. Now, unfortunately, most of the systems transpire to create what's called a vicious circle, which is down, 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 a race to the bottom. And in the food system, in terms of the overproduction of things we don't really need or aren't very healthy, or the overconsumption of things, that is a big problem. Now, although that is a good story, John and his colleagues and his friends like me, we did that. That was done by John despite the system, not because of the system, okay? You have to be very crafty, very cunning, and very clever to do that sort of thing. Now, so the part of the commission, with the help of people like you, is to understand those things which make that sort of story normal, expected, widespread, not a nice beacon, a nice story happening in an isolated place. So the incentives, the breaks, the policies, that normalises those sorts of really good stories are really important. And that's exactly why we've invited you to share your wisdom, to share your ambition, to share your experience, good and bad, of what we need to do in this country to make sure we do have a food and farming system fit for the future. Now, the other thing I should say is that John did not do this in isolation. He used the laws. He used the Social Value Act 2012, very underused piece of legislation in this country, to ensure that the public good is served by economic, environmental, and social determinants of health and well-being. Very important. He used the Climate Change Act 2008, very important piece of legislation. He used the Sustainable Development Goals, as we've heard a lot of tonight, as an international framework to which this country is a signatory. So those are all very, very important things. So I'll just finish by saying that you know, this commission is incredibly important. It's at a vital stage of its evolution in terms of gathering evidence to put an absolutely compelling case that we can do things differently. Because that's where John started from. He started with the idea that this is not good enough. The public deserves better. Patients deserve better. The planet deserves better. So the rallying cry I would have for you is that, you know, there is no they, there is no them. It is us. It is we who will be putting these proposals with your help to the policymakers and the public of this country. But we do desperately need your input, critical in the best sense of the word critical, to test these ideas that we're putting to you tonight to make sure that, you know, all these things that are happening, like Brexit, where we should, you know, we should never waste a crisis. We have to use this crisis as an opportunity. We have to see the best possible things we can possibly do. So I would leave you with John's rallying cry, which is always the fact that the real big, you know, the elephant in the room is what we are doing to an environment, what we are doing to our climate. Because Brexit, the credit crunch may sound important, but the climate crunch is by far the biggest elephant in the room. And if we can't solve that, we will not be able to face future generations in the face and said we did the best by them. So John's rallying cry was always, in this context, soil, not oil. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And as David indicated, all of these conversations, all of these debates take place in a somewhat complicated, complex, global economic and political context right now. And I can't think of anybody more fitted to talk to us a bit about that than my colleague on the end, Tim Jackson.
Thank you, Sue. And just to reassure everyone, my middle name is David.
So oh, I yes. Have a,
I think three things. One, obviously, and absolutely crucially, economy and those complex economic relationships, which we have so far begun to, really only just begun to delve into, in a sense. But what we find there, I think, is absolutely extraordinary. Ian mentioned the £3 billion in farm payments, but there's something like £270 billion going through the retail distribution and hospitality sector, all of which depends for its value on food, farming and countryside. So there's an extraordinarily complex value chain that determines the fate of what's happening in the countryside and what happens to farmers. And the critical question to ask about that is whether there is an appropriate distribution of the benefits and the costs. Who's paying the costs for our food and farming system, and who is reaping the benefits, and is that actually a just distribution of those rewards and costs? And when you look at it, and when we spoke to people on the bicycle tour, the one thing that really struck me was a quote by Mike, I think it was, who was working in a food factory, and he said, "How come my wages are so low? I'm working in a food factory. How come my wages are so low that I cannot afford to buy decent food?" And that was an extraordinary indictment, it seems to me, of a chain of injustice across the supply chains that determine the fate of food, farming, countryside, and the livelihoods of farmers. And that, I think, is something that needs to be unpacked. It needs to be understood. We need to follow that trail of money and understand where risks and benefits lie. And we need to say with quite a loud voice, I think, that there are questions of economic justice at the heart of what we're doing in the Commission. So that would be one of my findings from it. One of the ways that we've looked at in which we explore alternatives to the existing systems of retail distribution and indeed of corporate ownership is through the very small scale at the moment, but growing fast experiments in social enterprise, in working in different ways in the countryside. And across the country, there are now 100,000 social enterprises employing 2 million people with a contribution to the GDP of around £60 billion. Now, that's not huge. It's about 3% of GDP. But actually, what's happening through those experiments is a different way of organizing the production of the goods and services that we need to fulfill a decent quality of life. And some of those, many of those, actually are operating in the countryside environment where the returns to those activities are very low, but it doesn't matter so much because there aren't distant shareholders reaping as much value from those activities as they can without taking responsibility for the costs. The costs and benefits, as in David's wonderful example, tend to reside in the community itself for the community. And so we've begun to look at some of those alternative models. And one of the most striking ones to me, it wasn't entirely a social enterprise, but it is typical of rural activities, was a hill farm that I visited in North Wales. And the farmer there had been, the farm had been in the family for 50 years. The guy had who owned it at the moment had grown up as a boy on that farm and saw his relationship to that farm and to that land in a very, very specific way. And it was brought home to me. I was on a walking tour rather than a cycling tour at the time, and I was walking with my son and we were camping. And he had let a field for camping for largely itinerant campers on the farm. And he let a tent pitch on that farm for some ridiculously small price. And we knew, because we'd been to other farms, that this was not the market rate for camping in a beautiful location with a view to Snowdon and the sun setting over the Welsh hills. It was... And I said to him, you know, why don't you charge more? Why don't you charge the market rate? Why don't you charge what other people are doing? And he just said no. And I said, why not? And he said, because I don't want to. And it struck me how forcibly, actually, that there are values that lie outside economics. And I suppose that's my third point, that although economics is important and it speaks to questions of economic justice in particular, it isn't the only thing that matters in understanding the relationship between food farming and the countryside. There's an ethic there of attachment to the land. There's an ethic of stewardship. There's an ethic of beauty in the land, as Fiona reminds us in almost every single commission meeting, that there are values that lie outside the economic system that people attach themselves to. And it's clearly not right that the economic system should penalize them for that. But it is right that we should understand that a part of what we're looking at is actually a value system that goes beyond the confines of the economic system, and which we have to find ways to strengthen and nurture and nourish and support in institutional terms. And to me, it's so important, I think, that idea of stewardship, that I sometimes wish we had called this the Food Farming and Stewardship Commission. And then I could have looked at my inbox, and instead of seeing FFCC, I could have seen FFS Commission. And that, I think, is a wonderful thing and a wonderful way to think about the energy of our commission going forwards in the second phase. Thank you very much.
It took me a minute.
There you go.
Well, that did take me a minute, and if anybody else didn't get that, we'll tell you downstairs. Thank you. Thank you, all of you, for an illustration of the passion and expertise that you are all bringing, among the other commissioners, to our conversations. And I suppose you reminded me, all of you, in different ways, that one of the really interesting debates I think we've been developing over the last year is the relationship between public goods and public value. You'll all know, probably most people in this room will know, that there's been some very animated debates going on within and between government at the moment about what constitutes a public good and how we should pay for it. And we came to the view, I think, a few months ago that this was taking us down a very, very dark and blind alley. And there were other ways of talking about this that perhaps might be more liberating. We started talking about the notion of public value, which, of course, Treasury is assessed on. And we've, in our report, we talk about aligning the whole public resource even beyond that, NGO money, private money, you know, all the resource that flows through our communities to create public value, better outcomes for citizens, things that people care about. And with that in mind, I wonder, each of you, in turn, what kinds of resources do you think are currently not terribly well aligned that might be much better aligned to get better outcomes for citizens and communities? You can start with Judith. Lovely, thank you.
This is a true story, but I think it's really representative of some of the challenges that we have. So one of the other roles that I do is as a non-exec director of the Environment Agency, and we are spending a lot of our time talking about climate change, the impacts of climate change, and particularly flood risk and coastal management and some of the challenges. And clearly there is... a shortage of resources to protect everything that we would want to protect, and particularly if you're talking about certain urban environments and flash flooding because of surface water and those kinds of things. But interestingly, one of the latest flood defence schemes in Perry Barr in the Midlands, which was a £32 million scheme, was actually funded by a combination of government money, as in public money, private sector money, and crowdfunding, because basically that community wanted to further protect a greater number of houses, but on paper the business case didn't work out. But they felt so passionately about it, they managed to raise those extra funds to build a scheme that is far better than the scheme would have been. And I just think those creative ways of working where people understand that there isn't a perfect system, and we will never be able to find that perfect system, but actually, if you engage communities in thinking about what that community itself might want and what they would be prepared to work for, contribute to, you get a much better solution. And I think generally people are very generous in giving of their time and resources for the common good. And I think that's, you know, a great reflection on human nature and perhaps the way we might think about things in the future.
David Thurston, you're very involved in your local community in all sorts of ways. What kind of flows do you see?
Well, my view is that there are two separate things here. One of the things, of course, as a public good, which isn't really allowed to be a public good, is the production of food. And I think that we've got some difficult decisions to make about what food should cost in our country and how we get there. Because if we are working in a system as we are now, where actually nobody growing food is really making very much out of it because other people are taking the value, then that doesn't bode well for those people that want to feed this country in the future. So I think actually working out what happens on food is perhaps slightly different from what might happen in terms of some of the public goods which might happen at a more local level and the ones that we might deal with in our parish and other parishes. So I think there's probably two separate ways of looking at this. Unless people were prepared to accept food being paying a little bit more for food to cover the true costs, without damaging the environment and so on, which it might well cost for them to do. So I think we need, and part of our challenge is to have things that are going to work across the whole country, for the whole country, and part of it is about supplying food, and there's lots of aspects to it, and we do touch on it, food waste and trying to put better systems of distribution. But at the end of the day, someone's got to invest in actually making that happen, and not everybody can sit on a combine. So, you know, I think we need to just work out how that works in practice.
Pete, are you...
I think we should... I'll pass on this, actually, Sue, because I'm very interested to hear what the audience has to say. I would echo what David said, is that we have a terrible system of costing everything. Very, very few things in life are properly socially costed. most, I mean, I hesitate to say this next to an economist who knows 100 times more about this than me, but so many things, the price does not represent the true cost, not only to people who can afford it, but actually people who have very little choice or voice, be they elsewhere in the world or forward in time in terms of future generations. So I think David's point of proper social costing, where institutions, where governments have an incredibly important role to intervene and to make sure the public good is done sustainably and fairly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, the one thing is absolutely clear, that the countryside has an enormous value. The soil has an enormous value. The food production systems have an enormous value. Trees have an enormous value, and in all sorts of ways. So the trees are absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. The soil is producing fertility for nutrition. The countryside itself has an amenity value for people. It has a recreational value for people. It has an intrinsic value, its own value to society and to our sense of who we are. And in many ways, the failure to place that value inside of our institutional systems is beginning to break down some of the contracts on which society is based. So we're actually undermining certain contracts between the present and the future, between the old and the young, between the producer and the consumer, between the worker and the employer. All of those things are being broken by having value systems that are totally incorrectly aligned with the fundamental values that are provided by the land and by the soil and by the food system. And I think, you know, without going to the point at which we say the right thing to do is to come up with the number that we place on that value and then ensure that the market works in an efficient way to deliver the optimal outcome, which is exactly what Judith was arguing against, it is clearly important to ensure that those values are aligned with the production and distribution systems, which depend fundamentally on that value over the long term.
Thank you, Tim. Now we're going to open up to questions from the audience. Ah, brilliant light. I can see what's happening. So what I'm going to do is take two or three at a time, and would you please say who you are and if you've come from an organisation and if perhaps you're directing your question to any member of the panel. So we'll take you and you and then perhaps another person over at this side, and then we'll come over to this side after that. So at the back, please.
Is it working? Madam Chairman, thank you very much indeed. I'd just like to give you a further challenge, if I may. I'm a farmer, or a retiring farmer from North Wales, probably not far from where Tim Jackson put his pitch's tent that day. And I feel the most important thing in the countryside and in farming is not all about the soil and other things, which are very important, but about people. And we haven't heard a lot about people this evening. Now, that's slightly unfair, because Judith mentioned communities, and indeed Tim Jackson talked about people. But I have a challenge for you, and it is simply this. I want you to move in the young, and I want you to move out the old. Now, why I say that is because a number of things being mentioned from the platform. The young will grasp immediately. Opportunities. They can deal with the pace of change. They have the energy. They will innovate. They will take risks. They will give ground where necessary, and they understand the care of the soil. And I'm not saying the old don't understand that, but the young are the ones that we must look to bring about the sort of things your commission is hoping to achieve. And that means the old will have to go somewhere else, and that is not great. But you touched on something. I know this is close to David Ferson's heart. You touched on building houses on farms. We had to find a way of helping the old retire, and that is also very important. So that's your challenge, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. And this question here.
Uh, Thank you, Madam Chairman. And my question's addressed to Judith. And I've been following your report for a long time, the first UK agri-tech strategy. Hi, my name is George Ye. I'm the co-founder and managing director of UBPOS UK Limited. So my company is involved in a lot of projects in agri-tech. And also, you mentioned earlier, Judith, about flooding protection. I think it'd be really interesting to know, obviously, further about how we can develop, not just civil side policies, but also the technologies which my company is developing world class regarding earth observation and also agri-tech technologies to make sure that as global warming is getting worse and worse, and obviously we know why, because we got a guy in America called Donald Trump running the show, and it's not helping exactly get any better. But for the long run, how do you propose that government and also civil society get more information from technologies like myself, and how do we be able to serve society better in terms of getting, let's say, funding and also get more awareness for people of our technology and how we're protecting?
Want to take one more question before we come back to the panel?
Thank you. My name's Eric Millstone. I work at an outfit called the Science Policy Research Unit at the University of Sussex. And our collection of Davids highlighted the ways in which value in the food chain gets appropriated by different interests. And it's quite clear that a large proportion of farm incomes currently in this country are accounted for by cap subsidies, which the current government seem dedicated to abolish. So farmers are very poorly paid for what they produce. And farmers are, in effect, price takers. But the retail chains are the price setters. And this is a very perverse arrangement. And isn't it clear that in order to make farming viable with less reliance on subsidies, what's necessary is to break up the retail chains and end the oligopoly so that the food sellers become price takers, not price setters?
Some challenging questions, making space for young people, making space for technology, and making space for a multiplicity of retailers. Judith, do you want to start? Let's just go straight there, shall we?
I'm going to answer the question on technology because it's a really important topic. So Agritech Strategy was set up in 2013 to basically build on what was called the eight great technologies, so the things that we are brilliant at in this country. So really positive outlook. And 160 million was invested in projects and centres of excellence, and that money is now flowing through, and that will end in about 2020. And will be followed on by what's called the Industrial Strategy Challenge Fund, which is another 90 million that's been put aside for agricultural transformation, part of which is artificial intelligence, earth observation technology. But that only addresses a certain part of the value chain, and we need to connect it all. But there are some great technologies that are being now championed, and whether that's blockchain that gives us full transparency, or whether it's linking blockchain to some of those earth observation technologies, but also much more sophisticated earth observation technologies. So the reason I say this is the government today closed a commission called the Geospatial Commission, which basically was asking for feedback on the way that basically geospatial information is shared, because a lot of it is not open. So, for example, some of the things that we've wanted to do with agriculture and agrimetrics can't be done because of the license fees for the Ordnance Survey Master Map. That will be made open, and it will be made free so that people can access it. But there were three things that are the key barriers to that. The first one is interoperability. So you can do all of these amazing things, but if the data is not in the right form and the information information isn't the right form and it's not interoperable, then analysts and users spend all their time cleaning the data. That's not great. The second thing is the skills to be able to use that data. And I'm not talking about developer skills or analytical skills, but actually all of us being able to use that data in the way that we use Google Maps or the way that we use City Mapper or any of those other apps on our phone that we use in our business, in the way that we might use Excel spreadsheets. And the third thing is just the general regulation, standards, and I suppose enabling environment that only government can create, because the standards around data, data sharing, all of our data is something that quite rightly the public, us, are all worried about. And there aren't the rules around the use of that data and the standards around that data that truly make it accessible and interoperable. There is money put aside, so the funding is there. The strategy is going to be announced. It's set up for the next 2 years, and I would encourage anybody who's interested in technology, and in particularly the kind of technology you're talking about, to get involved with it. So thank you.
David, I'm going to ask you to pick up the challenge of bringing more young people in, because you've run a whole piece of work on that, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Thank you, Mark, for that. I chaired a report in 2013 looking at bringing more young people into agriculture. So it's absolutely right. In that report, we our conclusion was that it wasn't just about bringing more people, young people, into agriculture. It was about progression through the industry. And what we said in that report was the thing that would make the biggest difference would be a change to the CAP system, because let's face it, in some cases, some farmers were using the CAP payment and possibly some environmental payments to stay on their farms and not to retire. And that was blocking the space for new people to come through. Now, I'm not saying that they weren't entitled to do that. Of course, they were. It was their choice. But it was not allowing more people to come through. So there are some things in the agriculture bill. And there's a golden goodbye, which is going to take place. We don't know how that's going to work, but that will, some people will take that as a way of capitalising their payments and leave the industry. That will open up some space. And we are, I think you know, we're doing some local inquiries under this commission, and we are doing one in Devon, which I am chairing, and we've got a group looking specifically at new entrants, not so much the routes in, because I think we've done that quite a lot, but also why some entrepreneurial young people are not coming into farming. And I've asked somebody who heads up a college in South Devon, who's never had anything to do with agriculture before, to chair that and tell me and us all why his good students are not coming into agriculture and why they haven't even thought about it. And I hope that they will come up with some good ideas.
Thank you, David. And Tim, do you want to pick up Eric's point about how we secure more equity?
Yeah.
In
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of wishing I didn't let on now that my second name was David, the way you introduced it. But I absolutely take the point. I mean, actually, you could argue that all sorts of people are price takers when they should be price makers, and all, you know, workers are price takers rather than price makers, particularly in the agricultural sector. Young people are price takers rather than price makers, particularly in the housing market, and so on and so forth. And it is part of that broken contract that I was kind of talking about before, that when you force these distortions into markets, you begin to break down the fabric of how they work properly. And Adam Smith actually would have understood that perfectly. If he was very, very clear on the destructive power of monopoly in particular, and his response would be, and this is my only query to Eric's point, his response would be, you break it up or you have to regulate it. And the bigger the monopoly, the bigger the form of regulation that you have to impose on it. And that's very, very, you know, that's very standard economic understanding, and it's not articulated through policy, and particularly in the food sector.
Thanks. I'm going to just take one more quick question over here, because we are running out of time, and to say that we are going to be able to mingle and chat afterwards, and I'll say a bit more about that in a second. Just take one more quick question.
I'll try and keep it quick. Pete Chalkley from the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. I was listening to one of your commissioners speak the other day, Anne Jones, about the impact of climate change on her farm. Climate has come up a few times. Recently, the government has set a net, or has said it will set a net zero emissions target, effectively ending the UK's contribution to climate change. That raises questions for how we use our land in this country. I just wondered if there are any stories that had emerged over the past few months, particularly at a local level, at how people involved in the land are essentially helping to reduce emissions, but also thinking further ahead towards generating negative emissions through peatland restoration, planting trees, and so on and so forth. Mm.
I think this, I think those three questions on that were terrific questions, and I guarantee the commission will take those up wholeheartedly. Just linking with the young persons, I think that was a great question, and I spend a lot of my time talking to audiences, or actually more strictly listening to audiences about climate change. And one of the most interesting things is it's very difficult to teach young people anything about climate change. Okay, so they know it all. I mean, they know what the hell is going on. What baffles me is when people of our generation are sort of saying, oh, it's very interesting, and, you know, it is actually a real game changer. It's absolutely... So I think, I'm not an economist, but I think unless we break up this sort of hugely difficult thing to grasp, it's so existential and so wide-ranging, into the economic issues, the social issues, the narratives, the stories, so that it does add up to the scale that we need is incredibly important. So I think just people like you talking about the cost of taking carbon and other greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, rewarding people for that, incentivizing it, normalizing it. My background, actually, I spent a lot of my time on tobacco control. And for years and years, we as health professionals got it completely wrong by not quantifying the scale. You know, tobacco kills half the people who use it regularly. It kills them, okay? So most people know tobacco is harmful. Very few people know how harmful, okay? Most people know climate change is not a great idea. Very, very few people know that if we don't do something about it radically, it's game over. So it's a great question. So, yeah, I don't mean that to be a negative end to the evening, but it just reminds us all that we've got to get these things in proportion.
What I would say is that we heard so many stories on the bike tour that give me great hope, actually, that, as David says, people do understand it and people are getting on and doing practical things where they can and how they can. And that's partly driving our last bucket of activity, more than money. Where is the resources? How can we direct them more effectively? And how can we ensure that we enhance the social capital that makes all of that a reality? One particular example that I'll just touch on is in Lincolnshire, where we're working with groups of farmers to help them change their practice in a really practical way to improve the organic matter in their soil and water quality subsequently. And as we know, soil has the capacity to be an enormous contributor to carbon sequestration and dealing with climate change. There are many more stories, and you'll be able to see them downstairs on the interactive tools that we will have available. So before we close, I'm afraid we have come to the end of the evening. We do hope you will join us in our newly opened Rothmell's Coffee Lounge on floors -1 and -2 downstairs. Grab a glass of something on your way out and take it down with you. And you will see lots of artefacts and lots of collateral from the work that we've been doing so far around the rooms. And of course, we'll be there to chat to. We'd like to hear more from you later. But before we finish, I'm going to invite Helen Browning up onto the stage. Helen is, as you will no doubt know, Chief Executive of the Soil Association, Chair of the Food Ethics Council, and herself a farmer and founder of the Helen Browning Organics brand. Helen.
Thank you very much, Sue. Sue asked me to sum up. Well, that's a challenge, isn't it? An impossible job at the end of the evening. But I think you can tell that we have had an absolutely fascinating year. And a lot of people have said to me along the way, and I'm sorry that we haven't taken your advice, a lot of people have advised us to focus down on one thing. But I think you will have heard tonight and you'll see in the progress report, I don't think we're apologising for the breadth of what we're trying to cover. It is clear that in this world we live in today, we do need to see the whole picture. I think that point's been made really clearly from by our contributors this evening. And just earlier on today, I was giving evidence to the Ag Bill Committee, where everybody is getting into a real tears, quite understandably, about the detail in that bill. And it's partly because we're not seeing the whole picture. We're not seeing what's going to come through in the Environment Bill or in the food strategy, if it ever gets delivered, what the detail of policy is going to look like. And so we get very, very nervous and very pernickety at times when it feels like this is the only show in town. We need to see the whole picture, and I think this commission is trying to help us do that. It is both hugely exciting but full of treacherous moments and fraught with potential pitfalls, because not only are we not seeing the full picture of what government's thinking about doing at the moment, and obviously we're hoping to shape that, but also with Brexit and no deals, the trade environment that we're going to be operating in, and that ongoing challenge of dealing with the silos that are really dog us in every walk of life. It's easy to freeze, I think, and I speak as a farmer trying to make investment decisions, and a lot of you be in the same boat, but at the same time, this unfrozen moment does give us such a unique opportunity for change. So I think we're also not making any apologies for ambition. It is really important that we do set out some really audacious, but of course feasible, targets and not settle, actually, for less, even though, as David said so well today, we need that give and take, we need compromise. The answer is in that middle ground so often. But the big challenges you've heard about this evening, you'll see in the report, climate change, biodiversity crashing, the need to deliver great nutritious food, meaningful work. These are big, audacious goals. We're also making no apology for inclusiveness. It takes a lot of time to actually talk to a lot of people. But I think the hallmark of what the work we're trying to do is that inclusiveness, the need to enlist and support everyone who's up for helping to make this happen. And it's policymakers, of course, but it's everybody in society, and it's businesses too. Because one of the things that excites me is that there's an energy, an enterprise that can be unlocked by the work that we do if we get these frameworks right. We've heard a lot today about aligning policies and resources. They don't counteract each other. That will be so much more effective and cost-effective. I think Judith's case study on that was really helpful this evening. That idea that we're about creating frameworks and then allowing decisions to be made as locally as possible, and I don't just mean that geographically, as close to the people who know what it takes at the sharp end, and will actually not just know what it takes, but who will make it happen. That's a challenging thing to do. And I think it's important that we see the investment that's required in all of this as being pretty tiny compared to the wins. And what we've seen over the last year is that people care. This matters a lot to people. Despite its difficulty, it's hugely important. I think we've also heard this evening that a lot of the time that economics isn't up to the job, or our current economic system isn't up to the job, and it needs to be serving these issues rather than always dictating the pace. Anyway, as Sue said, many thanks to all of those who have helped make this happen. A lot of you in the room are in the room this evening. And do stay involved. So we really would like feedback on the proposition we've put to you, the progress report, what you've heard this evening. Is it making sense? What have we missed? What issues have we ducked? What have we misunderstood? Where are we getting this wrong? Where are we getting it right, maybe? Is it bold enough? Is it innovative enough? Is it practical enough? We're still really open for those radical big ideas, and actually the really important practical smaller ideas too. And I really would urge you all to stay involved as we go through the next few months. All the details of next steps and stuff like that are on the website, but do stay in touch with our work, and thank you so much for being with us this evening, and for many of you over the last year. Let's go and have a drink.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.